The title of this session is Ministries in Multicultural Settings, and then Partnerships with a question mark. And I think we left the title deliberately ambiguous so that we could change our minds about what we might do. And so we're glad for that freedom and hope that you appreciate it too. My name is Nancy Vignac. I'm from Tacoma, Washington. Just introduce yourself.
My name is Netter Hansen, and I've been here at Holden Village for a year, and I'll be here for one more year.
Cheryl Chapman, and I live in Portland, Oregon.
And what we were planning to do during this session is for each of us to share something of our experience with multicultural ministries and the church, specifically the ELCA in my case, and in your cases you can define that how you like. And then give you lots of chances for questions if you'd like to ask them. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about my own experience. I grew up in suburban Seattle in a very affluent suburb, an isolated situation on an island, and our family lived on the waterfront. Most of our neighbors were doctors and lawyers, and this was such an isolated and remote kind of experience that I thought our family was poor because we didn't go to Hawaii every Christmas. So just to give you a sense of how narrow my experience was growing up, I graduated from high school in 1965. Or 66. So, you know, just to also give you a sense of time. At that time, Seattle, at least the Seattle that I knew, was very homogeneous. And certainly the Mercer Island where I lived was very, very homogeneous. Even the people who were Jewish there really blended in to the rest of the group. And we all just thought they went to church on Saturday because their church was too crowded on Sunday or something. I mean, we just really didn't know anything. I had no experience of other cultures at all. And at that time in the United States, I think there was an emphasis, at least on the West Coast, towards homogeneity, and people didn't celebrate their own cultural heritage, let alone, you know, allowing for other diversity. Well, so then my parents wanted me to go to PLU, and I wasn't a very obedient child because I went to New York City instead, you know, 3,000 miles away. And I went to a women's college because I had a very strong feeling that it would be good for me to have some time in my life living in a situation that was not totally dominated by men. So even though I was, you know, living in this remote, isolated situation, I had some notion of something missing in my life. And so I went to a women's college, which was a tremendous experience for me to be in a situation that was not totally dominated by men. But now, this was also in the middle of New York City, so it wasn't as if this was a remote and isolated situation by any means. Once again, an island, Manhattan Island, but certainly not Mercer Island. And the diversity and the energy of that city was just thrilling to me. I loved it. It was a totally new experience. And of course, in contrast to the Jewish people that I knew on Mercer Island, I mean, people in New York have all varieties of Jewish folks, as an example. And it certainly celebrated their cultures and all of their foods and languages and so on. And that was true of all many, many cultural groups that I got to know there. I mean, even the Norwegians that I met there were much more involved in their culture than people in other parts of the United States. And my husband's family, well, we weren't married then, but anyway, when I spent time with Ron's family, that in itself was just an eye-opening experience for me. Because they were first-generation Russian immigrants, and they stood up at the table and shouted at each other and threw things around, and I just was really shocked. But I also loved it. And, you know, in all of this diversity and energy that I felt in that city, I thought, with all of this around me, there's got to be a place for me, a chance for me to grow and find out more about myself in the midst of all these possibilities. So that was wonderful. I loved that. Then the other side of it was I really was afraid. I was really afraid. And the school that I went to was on 116th and Broadway. So that's, you know, just 9 blocks from a major street in Harlem, which is 125th Street. And if you ride the subway up, you know, from the middle part of Manhattan up towards my city, my college, the population in the subway would get gradually, you know, less and less white and more and more blacks and Puerto Ricans. And every once in a while, I'd be the only white person in the car. And I was fearful because I didn't know those people, I didn't know their culture, and I was always afraid I might do something wrong and so on. And then, you know, sometimes I'd be walking down the street and there'd be these Puerto Rican men standing outside of their taverns or whatever they were standing outside of, and they'd say all these things in Spanish, and I always figured they were probably derogatory, but I didn't really know. And so that, all of those things made me afraid at times. And I got a sense of boundaries. There were certain places that were just, they made me uncomfortable, and so I didn't go there, and it was probably smart that I didn't go. But at the same time, you know, I was attracted to this energy and diversity. I got married, and we did some teaching in New York City, and then we had a chance to go and work in the South Bronx, and went to visit this congregation that had a school there and a congregation. And the people were just wonderful. I can't tell you how welcoming and wonderful they were. But we didn't take that opportunity because I was afraid. I said, Ron, I won't be able to walk down the street and go to the laundromat without being harassed by these people that were frightening to me at the time. And maybe would be frightening to me now too. So we didn't take that opportunity. And many years went by, and Ron went into the ministry, and we went all kinds of different places, and I won't tell you all about all of that. But we, at long last, ended up at PLU, and Ron was the campus pastor there, and I was, and we were both very involved in a lot of issues. And then there was an opportunity to become involved in this ministry at Salishan, and that was a chance to do something really wonderful. It's a new mission start of the Lutheran Church in a racially and culturally diverse part of Tacoma. Yes.
Could you explain, please, what Salishan is?
It's a racially diverse community on the east side of Tacoma. It's a low-income housing project, and the ministry is a new mission start of the church, of the ELCA. In my view, I could see a lot of things that had been part of my life coming together in this opportunity. We had said no to the South Bronx at that one time, but here was a chance when I was older and more mature to maybe do something that had a similar kind of opportunity to it. And again, when we visited that neighborhood, the thrill of the diversity of people there was really wonderful. And even our children, I remember, really responded to that with excitement. But I was also very concerned about how we would ever be able to relate to people who were so removed, especially from my experience. These are all low-income people and people from many different cultures. And I really didn't know if I would do the right things, if I would say the right things, if they would be offended by the way I dressed. I mean, I just didn't know. But we were hopeful, I mean, because we knew that God would be with us. And one of the things that I want to stress about this is that the experience of being welcomed into that community was all because of the welcoming embrace of the people who were there. The people in the community really invited us across these barriers that were in my mind anyway. In a very open way, by just saying, well, Nancy, it's okay, you know, loosen up, no, you're not going to say the wrong thing, no, you know, you can be with us, and, you know, this will be all right. And that was very important for me, to have that kind of help. And so I think I've learned to feel very comfortable in that community. In fact, I think I feel more comfortable there than I do any other place, because of the freedom that I think exists in that situation, of people being free from facades and being free to be themselves in ways that I think were very freeing for me. But the other side of it is, I don't ever claim that I really know what it's like to be a person that lives in that community, or that I really fully understand, let's say, African American culture as it's experienced there, because I don't. And there are times when there are jokes going on and, you know, things going on, and I just know I don't know what it means. But I don't feel afraid by it or shut out by it the way I might have at one time. And of course, sometimes they love to just do it just to tease, because I always fall for stuff. But I wanted to bring this up as one example of an experience that in my own life has been wonderful, and something that I think is a sign within the church that there are some efforts for us as a church to be trying to attempt ministries in areas where we maybe haven't gone before, and among people that maybe haven't been among us in quite the same way. And just as I want to hold this up as an example of hope within the church, because I think that these people that have not been part of us before bring wonderful gifts of leadership and hope and understanding and truthfulness that will really enrich our church. If we have the wisdom and grace to stand aside at times and allow new folks to take leadership and take places that maybe have traditionally been held by others. So there's one little glimpse of one experience.
What I'm going to talk about is a little bit different than what Nancy talked about. I don't really have a multicultural experience other than being married to Verlon, but I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience and maybe make some correlations between it and the efforts that the church is making towards being more multicultural. And my experience is being a woman in the church. I grew up in the Lutheran church. My parents are of Danish descent, and so it's the practice in our home that the kids went to church, went to Sunday school, but my parents did not really participate. In their upbringing, they went to church to be baptized, to get confirmed, to be married, and then to be buried. And that's pretty much the track that my parents have taken. But for me, especially once I got to junior high and high school, church was a place that I felt welcome, that I felt at home, I felt very nurtured. I was a very shy child, and so it was a place I felt I could just go and be accepted for who I was. But at some point, once I started really looking at theology, and I don't even think I knew that word back then, but started looking at what I was hearing from the church and asking questions that didn't make sense to me, like, you know, if God is a male and God is a father, but we're created in the image of God, then where does that leave me? I wondered, you know, does that mean that I have no spark of the divine in my being since I'm not a male? I wondered why the women in our congregation were not allowed in leadership roles. Why were the women in the kitchen and the men were the one making the decisions? I wondered about just some of the imagery that's used in hymns, the militaristic things. And these have been themes that I've asked throughout my life, but I guess even starting in high school when I asked, what, you know, I don't know what to do with this. You know, here's these teachings that had meant a lot to me, and suddenly I was questioning them, and the response that I got from both pastors and leaders in the church was, don't think about that. Your feelings are wrong. God is a father, God is a male, you're wrong. Basically just invalidating my feelings. And it wasn't that I wanted to tear the church down, I was really searching for answers to my questions. I've continued to ask those questions. When I got to college, I was active in a campus church and continued to ask those questions and was more or less given the same answers I received in high school, that, you know, this is doctrine, this is dogma, we can't change it, you change, basically is what I was told, you fit in. There's no room for the church to consider your feelings or your beliefs. I think even after I married Verlon, and he's a pastor, and questioned things in churches that we were in, or actually one church that we were in, it was the same response again, that your thoughts, your feelings, your beliefs are wrong, and if you want to be part of the church, you just need to accept what the church has taught for the last 2,000 years. And I guess my feelings are that if the church cannot make me as a woman feel included, and I'm not speaking for all women, I know that a lot of women feel perfectly comfortable, but I know that there are a lot of women who have similar feelings to me as I do. I guess I wonder, I think it's good that the church wants to go out and attract people of other cultures. I also feel at the same time that the church should look to the people who are in it already and try and listen to us and meet some of the needs of us. I just don't honestly think that God is a male. I think that God does not have a gender. And it's that sort of issue that a lot of people think is they don't think it's important, but it does affect my relationship to God. It affects how I pray. It affects worship, and I just think it's very telling that the church just doesn't want to listen. And just wants to say, well, you're wrong, and the church is right, and either you can fit in or you can leave, which is basically what I've been told in so many words. One thing that's happened since I've been here at Holden Village is that in an attempt to meet some of my spiritual needs and other women's needs too. This last winter had a women's group, which we talked about a lot of different things, not just spiritual and religious issues, but that was a large part of what we talked about. And not all women were there for the same reasons either. Some people were just there because they wanted to be with other women or they wanted to talk about different issues. But it has been a way for me where I could maybe explore some different areas of spirituality that, the church, the institution, just does not seem interested in addressing. And it's been a very good experience. We've, done guided imageries. We've talked about, what would it be like if women in our culture were honored and respected, and if the feminine was given the same status in our religion as the masculine, what would that feel like to address God as a she? What would that feel like to believe that I was as much created in the image of God as any man? What would it feel like to think that I could be a church leader, that maybe I could be bishop if I wanted to, because there are no female bishops in the Lutheran Church. So I think there are other areas that women can look to fulfill needs that they aren't getting fulfilled in the church. I think it's sad that I had to look for those needs in other places because I don't get much from traditional worship services. And I'm very thankful that I've had the opportunity to participate in that this last year. The one thing I want to say is that it was threatening to people. There were various times when the women's group had an event, and there was lots of grumbling among men in the village. Oh, you're putting down men. When it was really, the women's group had no intention. Often we hardly ever spoke about men. We spoke about women, and tried to celebrate ourselves and celebrate the feminine. And like I said, we hardly ever talked about men, but they seemed to think we were. And the one really disappointing thing was that at one point during the year, someone was so threatened by the women's group that they spread a rumor that we were practicing Wicca.
Witches.
We were practicing witchcraft.
Oh.
Which, you know, if you look back at the, people hear witchcraft and it sounds very scary and you think of the witch burnings, and personally I don't know very much about it, but after this rumor was spread that this is what we were, I looked into it a little bit and found out that many of the women who were burned as witches were actually midwives, or were people practicing healing arts through the use of herbs and spices and that sort of thing. And there, for the most part, there really weren't that many, quote, witches who were putting spells on people. They were people in the healing arts. So I guess I'm not quite sure how to end here. I stay in the church, even though I don't want people to think that I dislike the church, or I am hopeful that women will be given more of a voice in the church, and that we'll be listened to, and that our traditions, our feelings will be respected and honored. And I also hope that as the church reaches out to other cultures, Black, Hispanic, Asian communities, that they don't just try and bring these people into the church and make them fit in, make them accept the traditions, the worship as it is now, but that we listen to those people. What's the point in bringing these people into our communities if we're just going to plug them in and tell them, well, now you do things the way we've done for the last 2,000 years, and not honor their traditions or heritages. So that's what, you know, I would like to see happen, is that both other cultures and also women of all cultures are listened to and given their respect.
Okay. What I'm going to talk about today stems from a question that came up in one of the sessions the other night, where someone asked, is it possible to really have a multicultural church? But they know we could have a multiracial, but could you really have a multicultural? So I was just thrilled to be able to share that I have been a part of what I consider a multicultural church. And so I thought I'd spend today talking about what that church was like, and some things that I saw happening perhaps in that church that may not be happening in other areas, because I sense that people really want to know, how do we include people? You know, how do we really make them a part? It seems like a mammoth task, and it's like, you know, where do we even begin? And so my mind has just been rambling with, what are some things that I could really say? I mean, you almost feel like you want to say these things that can make people go out and bring these people in. And I know that I'm not going to be able to do that today, but I'm real impressed that people are concerned. I'm not supposed to kind of build off something that happened in the session earlier today, but I wanted to say it early and I didn't get a chance to, but now I have the power to do that, the control. And, you know, it just dawned on me when our spouses were talking this morning, and I thought about when Verlon and Kelly were talking about how they were, you know, what some of their experiences in seminary were. And it just dawned on me that the larger church has opened up and let, you know, people of color go through seminary. But the thing that they haven't done is minister to the people in the congregations to make them ready to accept
these ministers once they go through seminary. And just like it was, it's interesting to find out how many people weren't even aware of what ELCA's mission is in terms of including people. So it seems like we've sort of done some things up top, but we really haven't prepared, because it still shakes me that I meet people, white people, who seriously show an interest of being able to relate. The congregation that I'm a part of in Portland right now, all the people are super, super friendly, open and receptive. But I had to even ask myself the question, if the minister who is there now left, would they accept Kelly as a pastor of that church? And then when you think that there are a lot of congregations there that wouldn't, you think, why? You know, what is the real reason? And I think that helps to get down to, what is it that people fear? You know, as Nancy talked about, the fear she had of being uncomfortable about the other groups. You can always have fear of the unknown, and if you don't get a chance to know people, you won't find out what they're like. But, you know, are people still kind of caught up in things that they were taught early on, or things that they've never been exposed to? And so that's something that's still plaguing my mind. But before I start talking more, I thought I'd ask you a question and kind of see what kinds of responses I get. How many of you have been in a situation where you were the minority, whether it was based on age? Okay. Now, what were some of those situations? So I can kind of get a feel for whether the next question will fit. Art, where were you?
A friend of mine picked me up at the airport in Minneapolis, and he said, well, there's a party going on. You want to come? And I said, sure. And this is my friend Joshua Harris. So we drove to this party, and it was a black fraternity. And there were about 300 African Americans there. There were about 6 or 7 whites there, of which 2 were bartenders. I think, the only unattached male white. And I felt somewhat uncomfortable. What was intriguing is I was able to observe in the actions of those around me real overt effort on their part to make me feel comfortable and included in what was going on. And I achieved, on a scale of 1 to 10, perhaps a 5 or a 6 in that. And then my friend said it's time to go later on, so we took off. He and his date and I, and we drove her home, walked into the door, came back. And at that point, my friend told me that this was her first date. So bringing a white guy along on a first date, this guy was a real true friend.
Okay. What are other environments? Okay.
I had 2 occasions. One, I was a waterfront director in upstate New York for a Lower East Side Manhattan camp that was, I would say, 75% black, and the other groups were very poor Italian and very poor Irish children. And I had this experience after a number of years as a waterfront director at another camp where it was nearly all white. And I think one of the fascinating experiences that I had, that I guess more my wife and my children had, and my daughter was only about a few months old and my son was about 4 at the time, was how readily my son was accepted by, there's no line whatsoever. My son was immediately accepted by everybody. My wife was accepted, not by everybody, very quickly, because she was the mother of those kids. But it took me a while to be accepted. I had to prove myself as a friend, as a mentor, as an instructor. And there were still some of those feelings that I never felt threatened. Not that never entered into it. But my goal was to help as many kids learn how to swim as possible, and that was my only goal. And as soon as I began to sense that I was their helper and their friend, there were no barriers, and it was a good, very good feeling. The second time, I was a camp director for a day camp in central New Jersey, where we brought about 100 kids from the center of Trenton out into the suburbs every day on a day camp. And that was a fascinating experience too, but I didn't have any barriers to break down because this was an ongoing type of thing. It was about the 10th year of the camp. And I was, you know, 10 years down the line, of, and these kids had all been exposed to that environment, so there weren't any any things to break down. I think one of the fascinating experiences there was with a black teacher who was teaching in the suburban school where I was. And I hired him to be a program assistant. And he did not act, I don't know how to say this, but the black kids from the center of the city never accepted him to be with them, part of them, and they knew who didn't. And this one black teacher was not accepted by any of the blacks, counselors and children alike, where the rest of us were.
Okay.
It was fascinating.
Okay, good point. You all are answering part of my second question, so I'm glad you're getting both of them in without knowing what the second question was. Anyone else who wanted to share what the situation was?
This is a short vignette. I worked in a Cambodian refugee camp of about 35,000 Cambodians and maybe 100 whites. And we were accepted because we were white, we must be French, and we were helping, we must be Catholic.
Okay. Yes.
This has nothing to do with many cultures. A rural teacher, a teacher in a rural school can be a way out of it. I mean, you're the only person there, and they have different cultures than what you brought with you. It has to be very lonesome.
Okay, right. Okay, Mary?
Hill 57 in Great Falls, Montana, low-income Native American Cree, something like Salishan Place. A young woman from that community lived in my home for 3 years. And I would have to go and get her on weekends, and many times she wouldn't come back to school on Monday, and we'd have to pursue her, you know, and eventually she stopped doing those kinds of things, but at first there was much resistance to our to going into that community, and I felt a fear too of being rejected, but gradually we were accepted, you know, as soon as. And they put up with my do-goodism and all that kind of thing. And I put up with their playing of games. And eventually, they became real people to me. And I became a real person there, too, and my family.
Okay. Yes.
Well, this is not an American experience, but I was in Japan. And the only, in a place where I was the only non-Asian. And school kids kept coming up wanting to take my picture. I was really from Mars.
Okay. Okay, because what I wanted to get everybody to feel and think about, especially those of you who have had the experience, but those who haven't, if you could just try to imagine, the question isn't that difficult when you think, what is it that would make people feel comfortable? What is it that I could do to make someone who's in the minority feel comfortable? And some of the answers have been provided, because Art talked about how they tried to make him feel comfortable. You talked about how people seemed, they were definitely accepting, and how there was a lack of trust. Because you all really pointed out some things that I was going to say about what existed in the congregation that I was a part of. And you know, you made a good statement when you said people know when you like them, or people know when you want them to be a part of you. And that's so important. And people know when you're real, and it makes a difference when you're being real, or when you've drawn limits, when you only want to know people in certain ways or in certain settings and so forth. So I just thought I'd ask that question. The congregation that I was a part of, we never pulled out a book and tried to look up the ways to be an effective congregation. You know, we never used a whole lot of structure. We were a small congregation. This was in Greensboro, North Carolina, and they have a population of over 150,000 people. And in our congregation, on the rolls, we had maybe about 125, but regular attendance would be maybe 60.
And of course, some of you would quickly think, well, that explains it. I mean, smaller church, we could do more. And we're from a larger church, so I've already thought about that too. And I thought, now how can we still apply what some things happen within our congregation still to a larger congregation? The congregation started out as a center for social change, so it was not intended to be a church. And so it was built right in the center of a low-income housing authority, I mean, low-income housing project and area. So that was all African-American in that community. And you could not get to this church off of a main street. Matter of fact, you couldn't even see it. And so those were some problems that we faced later on. After they were a center for social change, they attracted a lot of youth. And this is something that was coming through a lot of Kelly's sessions, that when the youth started coming, their parents started coming with them because they wanted to worship with their children. And what was happening, this center was providing a lot of activities that would draw the interest of youth. And so that's how they pulled them in, and they developed the interest. And before you knew it, the people decided that they wanted to be a church. And so the church became a mission church, and that was about 15 years ago. And as of today, it's still a mission church. And so I plan to talk a little bit about that as well. So here you have this now mission church, like I said, off the main street, still in the same area. And we were constantly having to go through mission profiles, is what we had to do every year, and finding out why we weren't getting people in that immediate environment into the church. Well, rather than talk about some of the problems that I see with the National Church, I'm going to be like Ron and say, we don't want to dwell on that. I just want to talk about the positive things that I saw happening in that church. First of all, I was born and reared a Baptist, and it never dawned on me to be a Lutheran. Yeah, God works in mysterious ways. But so I was working, and so my sister and I had just moved to Greensboro, and we were looking for a church home. So I was asking all the people I work with, what church do you go to? So I was going around visiting all these different churches. But as I visited, I didn't find a church that I felt that I wanted to be a part of, because the church that I was born and raised in was a small church, and I was used to really working in the church, and I was looking for a place that I would be a member and not a number. So I finally asked this guy about his church, and he mentioned that they were a Lutheran church, and the first thing I asked, do you have a choir? Because I'm inspired by music and gospel music specifically. And he says, well, we sort of, but he didn't brag about it. So I said, I'm going to go check this church out. So I went, and I was so impressed by the emphasis of grace. Here this pastor was standing there, and he was not making me feel condemned by telling me how sinful I was and what I'm going to, how much repenting I was going to have to do. He was including himself as a sinner and just really emphasizing that grace. And I felt so good when I left it, and I was just really shocked. You know, but this wasn't, you know, I should have talked about the composition. I would say the majority of African Americans, but at least, well, close to 40% were whites. So we kept going, and my sister and I started taking classes, and of course we had to break the news to our family that we were going Lutheran, okay? And my uncle was so concerned. He's a Baptist minister, primitive Baptist at that. He was so concerned, he's tried to start a primitive Baptist church in Greensboro to save us from giving up our religion. So eventually our family accepted our church, and my mother and grandparents would always go and visit us. But when I started looking at the basic things that were happening in that church, it just happened. And we didn't go in wondering, you know, how do we like each other? How do we get along? How do we become this church that the Senate started using us as a role model for the multicultural church? Our money was shaky, but they always use us as an example of, if you want to see multicultural actually existing, Prince of Peace is the place. You know, I went in there, and immediately I just felt like somebody, you know. Once in a while I feel like somebody, and then other times I just don't know what I feel. And when I was a part of this church, there were people from all, you know, economic levels. There were doctors, and there were people who never completed high school, and you just had a wide range. And we didn't have very many older members because, as I said, it started out as with youth and the parents came. And so our oldest person was probably 45 at that time. But I felt real accepted. There was plenty of work to do. Matter of fact, we had to be sure that people weren't burned out because there was just so much lay leadership there until you just felt like even when you worshiped, the things that you were doing were a part of you. And I mentioned in the session the other night that, you know, we developed some of our own liturgies. And one of the things that we try not to do, and it's kind of hard not to do, is become emotionally dependent on a pastor. And it was good that we didn't, because I was there probably, 14 years. And we changed pastors 3 times. But I know that sounds negative, but it's not. One pastor moved on up to assistant to the bishop, and so that was a promotion for him. And whenever we look for pastors, we have so much to say. I might jump around. This is kind of like my style anyway. But when we look for pastors, we've never said we wanted a woman, we wanted a black, we wanted whatever. We wanted somebody who seemed like they fit what our needs were, and we could also fit the needs that they had. And so we ended up having, you know, white males, black female, an older minister, and we just, race just wasn't a factor. We really cared about what was happening in each person's life. We developed really trust levels with each other. People were on the one, you might say. I mean, really up front. We didn't put up a lot of pretenses. We didn't really try to focus on the things that we didn't have and some of our deficiencies, as Ron talked about the other day. And we didn't talk about why we couldn't do certain things because of the problems. We always tried to see what we as a church, even though we didn't have money to even pay off the parsonage or to give the minister additional. I mean, you're talking about, I mean, I know ministers that get vans and do all these, you know, I mean, just get stipends or allowances. We did the basic thing that ELCA outlines that a pastor should get, but we couldn't give extra kinds of things just to show, you know, how much we appreciate it. So we didn't have time to focus on those kinds of things, so we didn't build on our deficiencies. We tried to, we were always doing things within the community, always trying to see where we could reach out. And people were always involved. We didn't have everybody involved, but I had set a goal for myself when I first went there, because I feel like each person has a gift and something to offer, and everybody can do something. We didn't have the same people doing the same things all the time. I mean, oftentimes you will find people that you can depend to be there for most things. But if we found people who didn't initiate volunteering for something, either the pastor or a time when I was a superintendent, I would go to someone and say, you know, I noticed that you were particularly good in working with children or in doing this and doing that. And we would ask people, and this really seemed to give them a feeling of empowerment. And, you know, each time that I was writing down and thinking about what we did, I thought, well, is that any different from what other congregations are doing? What's the difference? What will it take as people, when people ask, how do we get people to be included? What's the difference? Again, as I said, just being as real as possible, empowering people. As I said, when you think about songs, when it's time for us to say, okay, what kinds of songs do we want to have sung in our congregations? We didn't just use one source. You know, everybody had an opportunity to attend this evening of picking out and selecting songs that will go in our own hymnal. And so if you really were concerned about having songs that were close and meaningful to you, then, you know, first thing I did was to call my mom, who plays for a choir, and say, you know, help me to remember some of these songs that I sang as I was growing up. And so it felt good for us on some Sundays to turn to a certain page, and there was a song that I contributed, and I sung it loud because I knew it better than anyone else because I had contributed the song. And then there were times they had to depend on me, someone who cannot carry a tune, to show them how to sing the song. Or, you know, we did lay sermons, and we accepted, people really felt accepted there. I mean, if you were bulimic, anorexic, interracial couples, people really felt that this was a place that they could belong and not feel judged, or that would stand out, that, oh, you're different and you have that problem. And so when people, because we were smaller, whatever happened, I mean, we were there, people felt it. We visited each other, we called. We did as much as we could. And even if you look at on a larger church, you think, well, it's too large for us to be that personal. But then I would ask, is it, you know, could it be done in smaller groups, but still smaller groups functioning somewhat like we did as a smaller congregation, but still bringing things together? And then I try to think about the congregation, as I said, where I am now. And I don't feel a part of that church, as wonderful as those people are. I mean, and I would never tell them that because I wouldn't want to hurt their feelings. But I don't feel anything when I'm in the service. I feel like I'm just going through some rituals. Some of the songs are really nice, and the choir that they have do some really unique and beautiful songs. But none of them are a part of me, and none of them touch me and where I've been in my history and what I'm about. And so I go through the motions, but I go there for fellowship, more or less. And Kelly picks at me sometime, and he says, well, you're sitting there looking at how the parents are getting along with their kids, because I like relationships, and I'm looking forward to having a child. Kelly, you don't mind me announcing that? No. Oh, that's on tape. Oops. No. But anyway, and, you know, as Kelly said, African Americans are really concerned with relationships. So I figure, well, Lord, if I have to be here and if I can't have part of the service, I'll do something that I think benefits me. And I just get involved with people in personal lives. But as far as a part of that church, I'm not a part of it. And, you know, you could say, well, why didn't you join their choir? Well, I could do that. But again, I would feel like while I'm in that choir, I'm not singing songs that have some of the meaning for me. And as I said, I wouldn't mind singing songs that are traditional Lutheran hymns and so forth. But I would like to see a part of me invested in that service. And that's one of the things that happened. Matter of fact, the church in Greensboro was called Prince of Peace Lutheran Church. And that church is very near and dear to me. Right now, the church may eventually phase out. It's gotten to a point where the larger church is saying, I mean, we can't continue to carry you on as a mission church anymore. I mean, yeah, you've done these wonderful things, and you've been very inclusive, but, you know, what's wrong? You can't bring in people with money, you know, and your numbers are, they're increasing, but you still can't support yourself. So the last that I heard, that church was going to have to hire a part-time minister, and when I was there, I used to think, is this church going to die, you know? But that church was feeding me so much, and I felt like I was feeding, too. And you just felt so needed, so accepted, just for who you were. It didn't matter if you didn't read your words or enunciate your words very well when you read the lessons. It didn't matter if your child ran up to you while you were doing a lesson. It didn't matter if you were late, but that was kind of traditional for me. And I speak for myself, because there were times that, I mean, I was the announcer there, and there was a time that my car was running with the keys locked in them, and it was time for me to do announcements, but I got there probably right at the time that the pastor was doing announcements, and I always had a thought for today. And so right as I walked in, he had just finished completed the announcements, and he said, I don't have a thought for today. And I slammed open the doors, and I said, I do. And I blurted out what the thought for today. Well, you could do that without feeling so condemned. I mean, they would try to tell you to work on that tardiness, but I never felt like something was wrong with me because I could not be on time. I might have been born with that problem. I don't know. You were just so accepted. Now, there were people once in a while that came in, and they came from churches that said, something is wrong with this lady wearing clogs to church. I mean, you know, those open shoes? Or these were people who came from African-American churches where traditionally you dressed a certain way. You know, we didn't wear shorts. I mean, the Lutheran church attracts a lot of people because of the dress code, believe me, but not that we want to get people that way. So there were people who had a few problems with certain things, but those were the things that we hashed out in retreats, in meetings, and so forth. And I'll never forget this one guy who I went to his home to visit. And we did the home visits that we all are supposed to do, but we really found out what some of the concerns, and that's one of the things that I miss at this larger church. I think a lot of things go on in that church that people never have an idea and never have any input on. And there's so much knowledge and wealth and intellect in everybody. And it just goes unused. And there are so many parts of us as individuals that are never tapped because there's not a forum and an acceptance and an openness for that. Well, Prince of Peace allowed that. As a matter of fact, it allowed it so much you wanted to say, give me a break. Okay, I don't want to use it anymore if I tell us, okay? I'm stressed out, too involved. But people just, you're like family. And as I said, if some child just learned that they, well, not just learned, but just started reacting to the fact that they were adopted and they had to be sent to a home to deal with the discipline and behavior, you were right there with those parents, crying with them, listening to them, doing whatever it takes. And people knew you cared. And it's not to say that everybody got along. You know, there were some people who really got on my nerve. But the love was there. And you knew that, as I said, the trust level was there. As I said, I don't know how else to explain it other than you're accepted, you feel real, you're a part of it. Leadership is so important. But then if we take that from this, I mean, how many of you can say that from what I've shared that goes on in your congregation? I mean, you would say that these are some of the things we do. I mean, you didn't hear something that you all haven't done or haven't dealt with, right?
I
haven't
experienced. We're not because of being small. That we don't.
Yeah, you got right.
I think that there might be some differences. Mm-hmm. And also, I have to point out that this we have only seven more minutes here. But
okay,
in my experience, in an upper middle class congregation where I grew up, there was a very strong emphasis on the surface. You know, the children didn't run up and down the aisles. That worship did go along at a very, you know, mm-hmm. prescribed way and so on. And along with that insistence on perfection in the worship service, there was also a great reluctance for people to ever confess that there was anything going on wrong in their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Children were doing drugs, that they had run away from home, that they were attempting suicide, mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. were there was a divorce in their family. All of those things were hidden behind this facade of, yes, everything is fine in our family. And so, right there in the church, which is the place of all places where one should be able to feel some consolation about these deep problems in our lives, mm-hmm. people could never say that anything was wrong.
Right.
And the contrast that I see from that experience in the congregation where I worship and live now is that people don't attempt to keep up those kinds of facades. I mean, everybody knows that their lives are troubled.
You know, people share each other's burdens is what it is. I mean, you're not afraid to admit who you are and what kinds of problems you're going through. So anyway, as I said, I still kept thinking, you know, how do we take what happened in Prince of Peace? You know, we got to get the people of color to the church first before we start worrying about how to invite them, but how to keep them there. But just being real, and people know that. People really know when you really accept them. And I still go back to my original question. What is it that makes me as an African American, say if I was a pastor, if there are some positions in the church that I would aspire to be in, what would make me as an African American woman be okay to relate to and talk to and acceptable and eat with and so forth, but not be able to lead a congregation in a basically all-white congregation or in certain positions? You know, why does the buck stop there? I mean, I'd like to have some answers to that myself. Like, you know, I just can't understand. It still bothers me, and I'm still bewildered by the fact that there's a line drawn for how far people are comfortable. You know, whites may be comfortable with me, or how accepting, or how much confidence they could have in me, or how much I'd be allowed. But, and some people seem to just really like relating to Kelly, And they'll invite him to speak to the church, and they'll invite the choir that I work with to sing at the congregation. But what is it that says he would not be accepted as a pastor there? You know, I'd like to have answers to that.
I didn't know that was the case. I wasn't there this morning, but I really didn't know that there's a line, or I'm unaware.
Is there a line, Kelly? Yeah, I would. Well, that's right. There's a lot. Well, you said this morning. I know.
I do a lot of work in the other larger church. I mean, in terms of synod committees and regional committees and national church committees and all kinds of things like that. And I would say yes, there is definitely a line. There's a perception that, well, these people of this category are intended for these congregations of this category. And then that.
We were on a call. I was on a call committee, and it was very definite who was filtered, who would be appropriate for us. Mm-hmm. We had no choice in which names we were given.
And I think that would be true for women and for people of various cultures and ages and all kinds of things. There's a question back here.
I was going to say, for me, the color line is there, and it's not broken. It's not even bent. And it's there, and it's like the church is trying to whitewash it, but that color line bleeds through coat after coat after coat.
I heard a Methodist bishop quoted as saying, "We, the white church, are all recovering racists, like recovering alcoholics." And I think that's very true. And I started applying it. And I have to say this about myself. I am married to a black person, but I still have racist tapes running through my brain. And the only way I can get rid of them is to acknowledge them. Mm-hmm. When I have a thought that goes through my head, if I came to Cheryl's office and she was a woman doctor, black, mm-hmm. I would probably take a double take, and then I'd say, "Why do I do that? Oh, I do it for this reason and this reason. Oh, all right. Forgive me, Lord," and then I go on. Mm-hmm. But I don't try to pretend that I don't have it. Mm-hmm. And I think we as white, we have to face ourselves and deal with that honestly, but not feel condemned or guilty.
Okay. I think a lot of it too, especially from my experience, is that I'm not competent enough. There's this prevailing myth that blacks just don't have more intelligence to work in an administrative position, to be in power, to be in control, without ever having experienced, you know, if you happen to be white, not having experience working with another person who happens to be of color in an administrative position, mm-hmm. Then that myth is going to continue in your head. And I think it's so ingrained that even if you think that you're not feeling that this person of color, primarily black, is competent, I think it's so ingrained that you automatically behave as though that person isn't competent. I think it's so subconscious and so deep that on top, maybe as a white person, you think that you're doing the right things and you're giving this person credit, but your behavior proves that you may not be, because I think for myself and for other black people who are, quote, professionals or in, you know, a position of so-called power, sense that. I sense it all the time. When I walk into a store and when somebody talks to me, I speak beautiful English, I think, but it's this, what did you say? It was as though they couldn't understand that I can speak good English too, probably better than they, you know? So I think it's so ingrained and so subconscious that it comes forth without a lot of people even realizing it, speaking in terms of, you know, the majority society.
And as Marion said, if we continue to deny that, then we'll never be able to learn any new patterns. Mm-hmm.
like I said earlier, getting to know people is really important rather than sticking with stereotypes and myths that we have.
It's a matter of black and white. I think even if you come from another country, born in another country,
right,
you still sometimes have to prove yourself.
That's true.
Just, I mean, I felt that.
Yeah. Yeah, it isn't just black and white. We just,
no, it's,
yeah, I mean, we just have to be focusing.
I have to go and pray for the beginning of this meal.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is the official end of the session, but if you would like to continue discussing, go ahead and please do that.
Yeah, because if you had something.
Thank you all for being here.